Is everybody feeling settled? Perfect. Then I will call our third case, Jesse Jensen versus the Commissioner of Public Safety, case number A23-1481. Good morning, counsel. Just as a reminder, we are live streaming the argument this morning, and there will be an audio recording on our website within 24 hours, but not the live stream argument. And there are no other recordings permitted of our hearing today. As I'm sure you are both aware, you will each be given 15 minutes for your oral argument today, and counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Because we're only making an audio record, if you could please identify yourselves and your counsel and your client for the audio record before you begin your argument, we would appreciate it. And with that, counsel for appellant. And the podium adjusts, so if it's not where you want it, please feel free to take the time to get comfortable. Don't want you peeking over the bench for no reason.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. Attorney Jacob Burkholz representing Jesse Jensen, petitioner and appellant. This is an implied consent case against the Commissioner of Public Safety. Three primary issues on appeal. First issue being reasonable articulable suspicion to continue to expand the original traffic stop that was related to suspended registration, 10 o'clock on a Friday night. What makes this case unique that'll impact all the arguments, particularly the first two, is the district court discredited a substantial amount of the testimony. And so I hope we can attempt to agree of what may or may not be the district court's findings. The district court's findings, very long memorandum, kind of references the law generally and makes some overarching conclusions. So I'll do my best to try and hone in of where I think this case lands in the plethora of cases of reasonable articulable suspicion and why this case might be different. And where I think the commissioner and potentially the appellant agree on at least a few things. And that is after Mr. Jensen gets pulled over, this was the offense from which he was pulled over was a singular offense related to suspended registration. So I don't believe there's any case law that would suggest that's intoxication. So it's not, and we might tie these into some of the cases that the commissioner cites, and I cite in my brief, which is State versus Clammer, Mesenberg, and Lopez. I think they're very distinguishable and have some factors that are not present in this particular case. Particularly, and I think what's also very unique is the district court credits Anthony Palacios, the expert in field sobriety testing for and of course, the judge discredits some of the findings of the officer and credits, and there's a lot of crediting and discrediting to the point I'm not sure we can fully agree, but I would say that the field sobriety and the commissioner would agree we're discredited and not a part of this on appeal. And so what are we left with? The odor of alcohol and an admission to one drink.
Can I ask a question before we narrow it down to that, which is, I wasn't able to find any case law that would explain what we are supposed to do in the circumstance that appears here, where there's expert testimony that says bloodshot, you need to have bloodshot eyes along with watery and glassy eyes in order for it to be an indication of intoxication. But we certainly have a lot of published case law from our court that would indicate that watery and glassy eyes without the eyes being bloodshot would be sufficient. How are we supposed to resolve, how are we supposed to resolve that question when I do think that the only expert testimony that came in is that the watery and glassy, or if I'm getting the terms precisely wrong, you can correct me, that isn't enough to show, to be a indicia of intoxication, but that we certainly have robust case law that would indicate that is an indicator of intoxication. And so I was not able to find a case that helped me figure out how we resolve that question, but if you had clear answer to that, I would find it helpful.
Excellent point, Your Honor. I don't have a clear case law or if it's kind of appellate procedure. I mean, if it, in theory, is
remanded. So you'd like it to be this one?
Yeah, then we have to bring it up to the next court to attempt to clarify.
And obviously publish it so that it's binding.
That would be pleasant and helpful for all defense attorneys out there. And
appreciate your candor to the court.
Yes, but I would suggest that the case law that Your Honor suggests is so clear is not so clear. And why it's not so clear is because the court references that, even in Metzenberg and others, that they combine bloodshot, watery, and glossy eyes with a variety. And then it's always goes back and they say, it's like this continuous self-justification on prior case law based on prior case law, based on prior case law. But what's the foundational case? It's not an expert testimony case. I can't find a single case that suggests, as Your Honor, that we have a plethora of case law that suggests in this unique circumstance that it applies.
I more mean that we have lots of cases, and I think that you're probably right, that we just cite to our old cases. But I think that we have a lot of cases that would indicate watery eyes, glassy eyes, that those are indicia of intoxication. But I wasn't able to, find a case where there was an expert called who was like, it's not, here's the handbook. And so I've been, and I would guess that a lot of that case law comes from police officers getting up and testifying as to their training as well. And so I guess that's an issue I've been wrestling with, and maybe there's not a clear answer in the law, so.
Well, to answer Judge Connolly, the answer is there isn't enough money in the defense bar to accurately litigate this, and we so poorly appeal cases that have poor facts that that's what happens. I mean, such often we appeal poor cases and we make bad case law for ourselves, and here we are repeatedly.
Well, we won't do that for you.
That's the goal.
So explain to me, I understand about the field sobriety tests, but then are you saying because he passed the field sobriety tests, he shouldn't have been given a PBT? So we shouldn't have expanded the scope?
That's the legal argument.
Okay, and this is new to me. I mean, I always thought there was kind of like it's a whole package. We're going to do the field sobriety, we're going to do the PBT, blah 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 blah, and I didn't know if you passed one, that means you can't go. You have to stop it, go, and don't get $200. What case says? Explain to me why that should be the case. or is this going to be the published opinion on that too?
Yeah, certainly.
But all of his points. Wow.
Yeah. I think that the challenge here is that the defense bar doesn't ever want to waive issues when we go through this process, and when we go through it, we're saying, well, where was the error? And if Fourth Amendment requires a challenge to the expansion, where along the expansion does the expansion get unreasonably expanded? It's easier in drug cases. It's easier where we have long stops for 20 to 40 minutes, and I've had those cases, and those become clearer. But in this case, when you refer to the package, it's a DUI stop, and so the officer's going to do what he's going to do, and why should I stop? It's particularly when the officer can articulate in the process, there are some real concerns that I think the driver is impaired, and why should the Court of Appeals come back and second-guess officers on DUI stops? I understand that. And it's particularly when we don't have Anthony Palacios at the scene at 10 o'clock saying, hey, you did it wrong, you did it wrong, you did it wrong, you did it wrong. I would simply state to this court that you're going to have to challenge it and win on appeal, right? I mean, that's the only answer, that this court shouldn't say to state troopers and officers, we're going to second-guess you on the scene. That might be valid, and you can continue. But if you're not legally sufficient, right, it's not enough. By law, right, that's the, I don't know if it's the George and Anderson line of cases that says, you pull over for the three headlights from the U.S. Supreme Court, and if it's a mistake of law, then, it's too bad. So if we can distinguish it on mistake of law, maybe that's where we have to leave it.
There are a lot of cases, because, here, It seems to me the officer thought he was deliberately not blowing correctly in the PBT, okay? And, there are a lot of cases out there on the test refusals, more with the breathalyzer, where, okay, he's kind of deliberately not blowing into the breathalyzer. We've tried this a couple of times. This is gamesmanship. It's refusal. Off we go. So why wouldn't the officer apply that same knowledge to think, okay, you know, maybe did or did not pass the field sobriety tests, but, you know, let's try the PBT, and it appears from the officer that he's deliberately gaming the system. That's part of the package, too, of whether there's probable cause. So why is that all wrong?
Well, I don't think it's per se wrong, because if we had a clear case so that he was gaming the system, we wouldn't be here on that issue. But I think the testimony, along with the expert testimony, even the officer's testimony, isn't so clear that he's actually gaming. He's just saying, well, I'm not getting a result, and I'm not really sure why. You're continuing to comply. You're continuing to blow. We're hearing clicks and beeps that apparently no one can quite understand except Anthony Palacios that says, we must have a reading, but I don't have a reading. And so, yes, I think the answer would be, well, if you do have reasonable justified facts that you aren't doing what you're supposed to doing, the failure to comply with the PBT can be a factor, the refusal by conduct in that process. But I don't think that the facts here would necessarily support that finding in this case. Again, very unique facts. And so I understand when you're trying to make a published case to say, well, how do we parcel this out if we rule it for the appellant, right? I mean, now we can't consider this and we can consider this. And I think the answer is, yes, the court can consider. But, we distinguish on the facts. And I think that's where, right, good appellate orders are. We distinguish on the facts. If these are facts aren't here, and that's why the district court's order, I think, again, highly supports the appellant's position in a variety of the sub-facts, obviously not the conclusions, that we wrestle with. And I understand that sending back to officers that you, what am I supposed to do? Stop? Not do field sobriety? And I think the answer is no, you continue, and you'll be assessed for that. It also puts officers on notice, and I think I have three of these cases pending in the district court, which is you're doing it wrong. I mean, the officers don't even know what the NHTSA standard is. That's what we continuously find out. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do. Is it bloodshot, watery eyes, or is it not? And they know the standard. They've been trained on it. They just honestly don't know. And when they find out that, oh, I guess bloodshot, you know, that is the issue, not watery and glossy, maybe they should go back and double-check their training. They do HGN wrong. That's what we find out. And so I think this appellate decision should be standing for the proposition that law enforcement, check your training. And if their training's right, we won't have these challenges. And if the training's right, we'll have a clear process. Why are officers going back and essentially saying, well, I'm going to deem it a refusal? It creates a very hard fact pattern for anyone to come to a reasonable conclusion, again, as are you, are you not? Am I going to accept the officer's opinion? Well, simply that's the dilemma, right? We have a defendant versus an officer. So from a credibility standpoint, we infer, essentially. We infer that, well, you must be gaming it because everybody else can do it. In fact, I get that testimony repeatedly. Well, if everybody else can do it, then, you know, I'm just going to deem it a refusal because I'm impatient. I don't know the answer. But we can get better cases in front of this court, better facts in front of the district court in this case when we get some of those answers. So that's kind of how I see the overall process and review from this court to district courts without creating more dilemmas as to how we're interpreting prior cases and going forward. It should also encourage, again, officers and more expert testimony, as in this. What are we really factoring? And that's where I think the cases are really boiling down, is saying, is odor enough? That's where I kept kind of funneling. There's an admission of having one beer, having the odor of alcohol. I don't think Clammer and Mesenberg stand for that proposition, or any case would stand for the proposition that we can expand and, in turn, arrest. And I don't think there's the PBT issue unique, but doesn't support the finding that there was an intentional or some sort of an obstruction that this court can find. There's a lack of clarity about how the PBT perhaps was conducted and complied with, but there's no positive PBT and there's no refusal to the PBT. Now, if this court were to expand the other direction and to say, well, if I don't get a PBT, it's also rare to not get a PBT. We'll almost always get a PBT, even when the DMT doesn't come through. And the idea, and if you don't know this, I'm not sure how to provide these facts, but the DMT is harder to blow in because it has a pushback back pressure. The PBT doesn't. So the PBT doesn't have back pressure, so it should be the easiest to blow into. that might make the officer say, well, then you're gaming it. But the facts show we have beeps and clicks and an officer not providing an answer. I don't think the court can then go so far as to say that you're intentionally obstructing the process. It also would go that Mr. Jensen didn't obstruct the process in any other way. He's very transparent, talks through the whole process, is cooperative, does all the field sobriety testing, is not argumentative, is not fighting in the process, is cooperative, and goes all the way through to the 36 minutes of his right to counsel. So I don't think that Mr. Jensen was, we can extrapolate and make those arguments that he's obstructive and argumentative and looking at the quote-unquote whole package. But obviously the expansion goes very quickly into the PC to arrest. And PC to arrest, again, more murky case law that defines that delineation. I think it's enhanced, they're separate, right? Reasonable articulable suspicion is lower than PC to arrest. PC to arrest is an honest and strong suspicion. I want to leave the court with, it's under the influence. Almost never do we get the arguments that we're actually under the influence. In fact, officers don't say that Mr. Jensen's under the influence. There's no honest suspicion he's under the influence. In fact, there's no slurred speech, no behaviors. The district court's findings suggest that. So if the court says, you know what, I'll dodge reasonable articulable suspicion, but there certainly isn't PC to arrest on an enhanced basis with more and less information.
What do you think is your stronger argument, the reasonable articulable suspicion? Because it's based on the more limited facts at the initial stop, or the probable cause determination because it's the higher standard?
I would think PC. I mean, I got Judge Ross to dissent in Helgett last year, right? I mean, he was a good dissent on PC to arrest, and I think that's a stronger argument, at least as to Ross, would indicate the facts and the law would show the higher standard, and the law saying there's fewer cases that justify the arrest in this particular case. I know I'm out of time. I actually thought one of my stronger arguments was right to counsel, but I didn't even get there.
Well, you can certainly talk about that in your 5 minutes, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondents. You can begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Corey Marsalek. I represent Respondent Commissioner of Public Safety. We're asking this court to affirm the district court's order sustaining the revocation of appellant's driver's license because the court correctly concluded that Deputy Myers had reasonable articulable suspicion to request field sobriety tests and a preliminary breath test. He had probable cause to arrest for DWI, and he vindicated appellant's right to counsel. I'll begin with Judge Larson's question about the expert testimony versus the deputy's testimony. I think it's a question of fact.
And our case law. I mean, we do have lots of case law that says watery eyes is enough.
Yes. And I think the foundational case on indicators of impairment is State versus Hicks, which I was just looking at 2 minutes ago, which is 222 Northwest 2nd. 345 at 348, which cites that foundation for required for an opinion regarding intoxication has been testimony concerning observations of the manner of walking and standing, manner of speech, appearance of eyes and face, and odor, if any, upon a person's breath. So I think what that case stands for is that it's the individual's observations.
And what year is that from?
Sorry. 1974. Okay. And then that's later cited by Holtz, which talks about one indicia being sufficient depending on the circumstances.
But certainly the science could change, right? Like, and I'm asking about the year because certainly science could change. We could learn new things. I mean, that's why we have updated manuals and cops get updated training. And so I guess I've been struggling with if there is a real change, right? If glassy eyes is not actually a good indication of impairment from alcohol. How do we resolve all of this existing case law that says that is in the midst of an expert getting up and testifying? Like, this is no longer best practice to be looking at watery eyes.
Well, I think it's it's not an exhaustive list. And I think that's where how the district court resolved it is that, yes, in Mr. Palacios' training, he doesn't think that it is an indicator of impairment, but in Deputy Myers' experience, it was, and the district court on page 23 of its order credited that in Deputy Myers' experience, this is an indicator of impairment to him to support probable cause. And I think that's also the standard that we're looking at is important because it's not necessarily whether or not this is in fact an indicator, it's whether or not a prudent officer would believe that this is in, would have a strong suspicion that this was an indicator of impairment. And so that's where I think that, yes, science does evolve, science does change, and that's why it's a non-exhaustive list that is based off of what the district court hears, and the district court is in the best position to resolve those concerns about whose testimony is more credible, whether or not their testimony is such that they it is an indicator of impairment or not. Because, again, it's a totality of the circumstances.
But you don't disagree that there could be, right, that police officers have been trained on an improper factor, and we may learn that that's not a proper factor, and that the police officer might get up and say, this is what I've been trained on, and so I think it's an indicator of impairment. And when we have an expert that says, but that's not best practices, that's not what we do, doesn't that put us in a little bit more complicated position? Because I understand that these, and correct me if I'm wrong, that these manuals are supposed to be the standards that the police officers are applying.
I agree with that, Your Honor, but I think that it's a complicated question of fact. And it's a question of fact for the district court to resolve whether or not that, you know, is this something they're trained on? Is their training proper? Are they following their training? I think that's something for the district court to resolve.
So we should not rely on our case law because it's a question of fact, and in each individual case, that's how we're going to develop this issue.
No, I think what the case law recognizes is that this is something that is a well-recognized indicator of impairment, but totality of the circumstances analysis where there could be individual circumstances where maybe an indicator of impairment is not present based on what the district court finds. But if the district court finds that, yes, this was observed, and yes, we can rely on that because the Court of Appeals has affirmed that this is a recognized indicator of impairment. But again, it's a totality of the circumstances.
But I'm certainly not a scientist, so.
Right.
So this case, I think, is harder for you because the officer didn't see signs of impaired driving. He saw a suspended registration and stopped the car based on that.
I agree that that's what the initial stop was based off of, but as the deputy testified and as the district court found, it took the appellant 45 seconds to stop, and that was an unreasonably long time that the district court found was an indicator of impairment based on the time of day. So I think there was an indication of impaired driving. The 45 seconds that it took to stop, I believe that's on page, I forget what page of the district court order. I believe it's on page 4 or page 9. I know the district court also mentions it on page 23 in its probable cause analysis.
5 seconds doesn't seem that long to stop. With another case where today where it took 6 minutes, that's a long time to stop.
Well, I think that the deputy testified to and what the district court credited is that it took an abnormally long time to stop under those circumstances where the appellant turned onto this gravel road and instead of just stopping on a flat part of the gravel road, he just kept driving with the deputy behind him and his emergency lights activated. And that's what made it an abnormally long time to stop under those circumstances. And that's why the deputy testified that it was an indicator of impairment. The district court credited that, and that was further bolstered by the time of night, which was 10:49 p.m. on a Friday night, and as Judge Connolly's opinion in Otto articulates, that driving conduct at a time of day when impaired drivers are more likely to be found is an indicator of impairment. So we have that as an indicator of impairment. We have the district court crediting the watery eyes. We have his admission to consuming alcohol and his refusal to conduct the PBT. Now, State versus Leducer says that usually an admission to drinking coupled with other factors is sufficient for probable cause.
What are we to do with the clicking of the machine?
Well, as the district court found, the district court credited the deputy's testimony that there was this extra click, and he noted on the video immediately that this was an RFI, which further bolstered the district court's finding of credibility for the deputy that...
Wasn't that for the first one, though?
Correct.
I mean, so there's three... There were three blows into the machine. The first one was an RFI, and the second two isn't the testimony from the expert that all the relevant clicks happened. I mean, isn't that what we're... I mean,
no,
you can tell me that I'm...
No, Your Honor, my understanding...
Not recalling the video correctly.
My understanding of the record is that he attempted three different preliminary breath test samples. On the first one, they heard the three clicks plus an extra click that got the RFI code. So then he attempted to administer two other PBTs. And when he administered the two other PBTs, there were no clicks because appellant didn't provide a sufficient breath to
so
even
there were
get
no
to that
beeps
point.
And clicks for the second two.
Correct. That is
the
my
record. Okay.
That is my understanding of the record. And even on the third one, the testimony that the district court credited was that the appellant blew into the machine. So then going back to Judge Conley's point during appellant's argument, that's similar to the DMT test refusal cases. The conduct that appellant engaged in by not blowing hard enough and eventually sucking into the machine indicated that he was refusing the PBT, and that conduct was also what the district court took into account to find probable cause. And then turning to the vindication of appellant's limited right
Can
to
I ask one more question about the slowness of the stop? Because, I mean, this is something that I struggle with as a person who's, like, gone to safety classes and get instructed on things like if you see lights behind you and you fear that it's not a police officer or you have some fear, you are allowed to drive to a place that's has bright lights or call into 911, drive to a place where you feel safe before you stop the car. And I see a lot of these cases where we're like, oh, they're slow to stop because it took them 45 seconds or a minute. And I always struggle with how do we look at that when there might be reasons that a person is calculating in their head, do I feel that this is a safe place to stop? I'm looking behind, is this actually a cop car? Things that, you know, I think that if you take a safety training class and you're of a particular gender, you're sort of told to, you're told to do as a matter of your personal safety. And so I do struggle with like a 45 second delay and how do you know that that's impairment as opposed to a person doing some of those evaluations that they're supposed to do to protect their personal safety. And I struggle with developing a line of case law that says every time a person delays for 45 seconds, that that shows that they are not wanting to comply with the officer as opposed to doing a personal evaluation of their for safety reasons.
I understand your concern, Your Honor. Again, I think this is a totality of the circumstance analysis, so I don't think this court has to say as a matter of law 45 seconds is or isn't an indicator of impairment. I would say that in this case, Your Honor's concerns would be speculative because there's nothing in the record to suggest that
I understand that, yeah.
But I guess, where I was going with that is that, you know, if the deputy had come to the stop and then the driver had hypothetically said, oh, I didn't stop because I had this concern, that concern, that concern, the deputy would say, well, my suspicions of impairment for that may have been dispelled at that point, or the district court could also find that. That's not what happened here. So that's why I'm saying it's a totality of the circumstance analysis, and I think that the opportunity to dispel suspicions is a bulwark against that sort of concern about having a per se rule when there are probably there are other situations where there are other circumstances that could justify why a person did what they did. And if those concerns are communicated to the officer, because we are looking at it from an objective officer's point of view based on the information available to them at the time, then in those circumstances, maybe suspicion was dispelled, and that's something that the court would not credit as an indicator of impairment. Again, that's not what happened here. There's no indication from appellant anywhere in the record that he communicated either to the court or to the officer as to any concerns for why he stopped, other than to say that he thought he was navigating up a hill, but the district court discredited that based on Deputy Meyer's testimony in the video. So again, under the totality of the circumstances, the district court found that his 45 seconds to stop was an indicator of impairment in this specific case, and I don't think this court has to go any farther than just crediting the totality of the circumstances that the district court considered here.
You can move on to your other argument. Oh, sure. I'm sorry. I wanted to ask the question while you were in the right part of your outline. Yep.
And then with respect to the vindication of counsel, you know, here the appellant was provided 34 minutes. Deputy Myers provided him. Deputy Myers looked up every number he asked him to. He allowed the appellant to verify every number he was looking up. He even warned him multiple times that they were coming close to the end, and even after saying that he was going to end the attorney time, he then allowed him to attempt to call another attorney. So I think under the case law that we cite, it was reasonable under the totality of the circumstances, the amount of time that the appellant was given and the numbers that he was allowed, all the numbers he was allowed to call were reasonable, and this court should affirm the district court's order.
Is there anything in the record about why the officer didn't start earlier allowing him to contact attorneys? Because, I mean, all of this is like there's sort of the deadline coming up where the testing is not going to be adequate. What do we have in the record with respect to why, not the back end, not why didn't it go longer, but why is there anything in the record about why it didn't start earlier?
I don't believe so. My speculation is the amount of time it took to get to the station from where he was, because I know it is in the record that his partner was so far away that they couldn't even bring another PBT to the scene because it was going to take too long for the other officer to get there. So it's not in the record as to why it took so long for them to begin it. I believe, like I said, I'm purely speculating that it was how far away they were. But I will note that we cite, I believe it's Padilla, in a footnote that the amount of time it takes to get to reading the breath test advisory does not negate the, does not ultimately have an effect on the right to counsel, because it's like the fact that it was started later does not mean that it was a per se violation of the right to counsel.
So. I mean, but you wouldn't, I don't think that you would disagree that if you gave the Padilla instruction and the amount of time for the validity of the test was 2 minutes and said you have 2 minutes to get the right to counsel, right? I mean, there's a spectrum. There's certainly a spectrum there where you can't give the instruction right at the time that the testing would no longer be valid and have that be okay. That wouldn't be a vindication of your right. And so I just wanted to evaluate sort of the spectrum and whether there were facts here that said, you know, 37 minutes is just what was going to happen given the circumstances of this case.
And I see my time has expired. May I answer your honor's question? So I think that would be a question of just how much time they were given and whether or not that was reasonable, when it was started and why it was started. I don't know if there's case law and whether or not that factors into the equation. Like I said, I think the principle would be, well, they only gave him 2 minutes because they were up against the two-hour window. I mean, maybe 2 minutes itself would be unreasonable in that circumstance. But again, in that situation, I think we would hope that there would be record evidence as to why it took that long. Like I said, there's nothing in the record here as to why it took that long. And again, he was provided with 34 minutes, which at that time of night, there are other unpublished cases from this court that support that that is reasonable so long as he was provided with the opportunity to contact attorneys, which, as the record shows, he was here. And on that basis, we would ask this court to affirm.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you'll have the last word. And counsel for respondent teed you up really well for what you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I don't want to miss an opportunity. Thank you, Your Honor. Right to counsel, I think it's on the edge of the spectrum of cases. Certainly, it's not a slam dunk right to counsel issue. But a couple of key facts that differentiate it from some of the other cases the state would suggest. I think the two-hour window is just an artifice. There's actually no case law that says that state is actually against a two-hour window. There's retrograde extrapolation, and it doesn't prevent any probable cause for them to charging anyone just because you're outside the two-hour window. And there's case law on that. So why is when the deputy suggests, well, we're running out of time, what time? And that's the dilemma. In fact, I'm sure the AG's response to that is, well, it's a totality of the circumstances. And it's the back-end argument that the justification...
as time wears on, the effects of alcohol wear off. I mean, it's not like, you know, I mean, that is true. Hmm. So, what would we have to say then? I mean, that he gets to have enough time until he actually reaches an attorney?
Good point. When's enough enough? And that's a great point. I think what makes, again, this factually difficult, I think, for this court to affirm is that the access to the information was controlled by the officer, right? That's a very unique fact that we're Googling.
Get his cell phone?
Or phone book. He's not allowed, right? Kuhn and other of these cases, even in Downs, they get 30 to 35 phone calls to look up attorneys. In this case, he only gets a handful of calls. He actively calls and continues to ask for an attorney. Very different fact set of circumstances. Nothing's explained to Mr. Jensen that says, well, why can't I, right? If we're going back to the foundational principle of the right to counsel, it is the state's obligation.
The reason is, because if they say the wrong thing in response to a question, the defense bar crucifies them. So they stick to the script. And, you know, not exactly a bad plan, stick to the script. I mean, this would be a different case if he said, you know, the only person I want to call is Mr. Burkholz. I got his number in the cell phone. It's on speed. I have his secret number in the cell phone that he always answers because he knows it's me. And they didn't give him the cell phone. Then I'd say, well, you know, that's a problem. But he didn't say that. You know, again, speaking for myself and not my Treasurer colleagues, this does not seem to be anything except your typical, we gave him what we gave him, he didn't reach anybody, 34 minutes, okay, it's not as much as 40, it's more than 25. How is this reversal?
Right, the argument, if it's focused on time, it's close enough, you've made your efforts. I think if the court focused on...
Well, I mean, we would have to say, wouldn't we? You know, he's still trying to get an attorney. He's not reaching one. Therefore, he gets to stay on the phone until he actually has a phone conversation with the counsel so he can give informed consent. I mean, wouldn't we have to say that in order to reverse this case?
No one likes to make bad case law. I get that.
Well, you know, the Supreme Court says we do it all the time, so don't worry about that.
That's right.
What? Wouldn't we have to say that?
No. Look back to the foundation. If we're handing phone books out, right? If there was phone books, and this is when you stick to the script, most officers are trained to say, here's your room, we put on the camera, go make your calls, and they leave. And so this is very different. We got an officer-controlled environment. I'm only going to Google and get information. I'm going to get you only what I feel I want to get you. And then if, again, you're not doing things fast enough, then I'm going to say, you know what? I'm going to put an arbitrary time limit on it. We know it's arbitrary, 25, 40, 50.
I mean, this is not the case where, you know, the deputy only, you know, I only give them the names of these three lawyers, and that's that. Okay, I mean, that's not this case. I mean, is there any indication it's like he was trying to get a hold of some lawyer other than what he was being given? Or that the deputy was, well, it's only going to be these 10 lawyers because I know they're terrible and none of them are Mr. Burkholz, so by God, these are the only lawyers he's going to call. I mean, that's not this case either, right?
Certainly, we always want our facts to be better than we have them. But I think the interesting question Your Honor poses is, okay, so then what is the officer supposed to do and in what environment should he be doing it and when does that become a violation? And I think the officer in this case, again, the error stems from the premise of he's controlling the information, he's controlling the time. When there is no time, or as Your Honor, Ms. Larson pointed out, that there is no urgency here, or the urgency wasn't created on Mr. Jensen and he wasn't aware of this urgency or a time limit in order to do so, and wasn't given phone book and time alone. I just think that's a significant factor for this court to say, if you don't allow drivers, and when we stick to the script, you give them the phone books, you give them the opportunity to make all the calls and let the appellant, or in this case, the suspect, make the efforts he needs to make. And the officers that I think do it well go back and say, Did you have enough time? Did you reach him? And they almost all say, I'm done. I've made my calls. And that's the line that I think it's drawn. And when a person begins to claim, you've made 20 calls, and you still want more, that's enough. Or again, no opportunity that was provided, I think, this minimal opportunity and time alone, for whatever reason, we're stuck in the Hicks. I don't know why they weren't given phone book and an opportunity to be alone, but that's what makes this case unique with the officer standing there controlling it.
It's not like they make a lot of phone books anymore. I mean, you know, when was the last time you got a phone book delivered to your house or actually tried to get one? I mean, I wouldn't even know who to call. You know, I mean, the hardware store gives you a phone book of the 12 repairmen that are all related to the guy who owns the hardware store. But
well, if you move up to Brainerd, you still get one delivered to your house.
Well, yet another reason to move up north. I don't know.
The blue book still exists. There are still books and an opportunity until, and if there was no phone book,
well, then we'd be hearing the argument. Well, it's a 2005 phone book, and you should have given him a 2023 phone book. And because you didn't give him
would be a problem, probably a 2005 phone book.
Well, they've got to get the newest phone book every year, and that's the phone books they got to give to the guy.
Can I ask one clarifying question? What specifically do you think because I think it's hard in a case, you can certainly see how a cell phone gets left behind at the scene, because I leave my cell phone behind accidentally all the time. And so in the hustle of everything that's going on, you can see how a person's cell phone gets left behind. With that in mind, what do you think the officers specifically should have done differently here? And is it the instruction should have been given earlier? Is it that they should have been in their own private room? Where is it that the cops went wrong?
Yeah, I think the answer is...
Because I have trouble saying because they left his cell phone that by itself is going to be the fact.
Right. And we're looking at the after kind of found facts. I think the foundational facts are the officer has to make that time available for the driver to make the decision with that full opportunity. And whether, again, phone book or internet or his own cell phone, that opportunity is up to the officer to make it available and give that driver the time to do so. And again, this 35-minute illusory time period is, again, even further minimized by the officer. So, again, what's supposed to happen? 25 to 40 minutes with an opportunity with phone books, cell phone, or other technology available, Google, phone book, and that time frame with an active search for an attorney. The officers can always jump in and say, are you done? Have you had enough time? 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 25 minutes, 35 minutes? And at some point, they're going to say, you're not making efforts. Didn't happen here. You've made 20 phone calls. Again, nothing in the record here. All we have is someone who's made a couple of calls, doesn't have access to information, and is cut off by the officer. So those factors, I do think, I understand it's unique, and we're not necessarily looking for lots of bright line rules. And ironically, I was in the Nobles County Courthouse and saw a 2014 phone book in the conference room.
Well, thank God you didn't use it.
Yeah.
To call a lawyer.
I was going to send photos to Bill Wettering and others about how nice they looked in the phone book 10 years ago, and how they're probably not, most of them weren't even still alive or in business. And so very good point as well.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel in this case. This case has been submitted. We will issue an opinion within the time prescribed by statute. And with that, our oral calendar is over this morning, and we will adjourn to confer on our non-oral cases.